You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we find out what it's like to be a human book in the upcoming Real Life Library Project.
First, opiate addiction has quickly become a growing epidemic in Wisconsin and the rest of the country. And our next guest is working on standards for the use of opioid prescriptions and alternatives for pain management.
Dr. Ala Abdel-Sayed joins us now. He's a medical director for pain services at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Al, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, first, can you talk about the work you do at the pain management clinic?
So at our pain management clinic, we have been working on improving, of course, the health and the pain control for our patients, and particularly by using alternatives to opioids. With all the troubles going on with opioids right now, side effects, mortality, and abuse risk, we started using just alternatives, and we succeeded actually to improve the pain control to our patients significantly without the need to fall much on opioids.
So what alternatives are in the toolkit to try to avoid or at least minimize opioid prescriptions?
So there are several groups of medications, starting with over-the-counter medications, NSAIDs, anti-seizure medication, antidepressants, and several other medications which actually have a very strong evidence in literature and research that they are very effective in treating pain. And the evidence of using VIN is much stronger than actually any evidence for using opioids and controlling pain. And then we also started using other tools as pain psychology, group support in complementary medicine. And patients who fail kind of those lines, we start working with them by interventional procedures and even advanced implants to be able to control their pain without actually having to use high-dose opioids or having many patients on opioids.
Now, are we talking mostly about people with chronic pain here, not somebody recovering from surgery or an injury, but somebody with some kind of longer-term pain condition? Is that mostly what you're focusing on?
That's correct. We're talking about chronic pain patients who are way out from a surgery or had it for several years. So it's not an acute post-operative surgical pain.
A lot of times when we talk about the problem with opioid addiction, we hear from people, and there are a lot of people out there who say, you know, I'm worried, I rely on opioid pain relievers for my chronic pain, and I'm worried that that's going to be taken away with nothing left to replace it. What do you say to people in that position?
So I'll say I want people to be assured that opioids are not the only group of medication that we use for treating pain. Second, even if we have to wean patients off opioids, this has to be done very gradually in a way that will not harm the patient, cause any withdrawal, and while at the same time using other medications and tools to treat pain. So if it's done really this way, there shouldn't be a concern that a patient will suffer pain or will have zero opioids all of a sudden and continue to be in withdrawal. So if things done really the way I said it, it shouldn't be a problem.
Now, I've seen at least some research out there. I don't know if this is a closed book yet, but in some cases for some kinds of chronic pain, it looks like opioid pain relievers may actually make things worse, make the pain conditions worse, not better. Is that right?
This is correct, and actually there is a strong evidence and multiple studies that showed that opioids in high doses can cause what's called opioids-induced hyperalgesia, which means increased sensitivity to pain, actually, so they can cause pain. And in those conditions, if you wean down opioids, the pain condition improves, plus many of the other side effects, other than talking about tolerance, abuse, or addiction, but actually they can cause nausea, vomiting, constipation, can cause also harm to body organs. So this all has been well proven in literature.
Talking to Dr. Ala Abdel-Sayed, talking about pain management in the age of opioid addiction. He is medical director for pain services at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. And Dr. Al, I understand you work on standards for doctors in how and when to prescribe pain relievers, opioid pain relievers in particular. What kind of messages are you trying to get out there to doctors who are dealing with patients every day?
So we established multiple groups and committees to help our primary care providers and other providers who deal with patients in chronic pain about developing algorithms about how you should start evaluating the patient and which medication should be started at first. And by all means, we never keep opioids as a first option, but we ask the providers to use other methods like the physical therapy, pain psychology, non-pharmacological methods at first, then start using some of the pharmacological agents, so the ones that over-the-counter first, and then, as I mentioned, the anti-seizure medication, antidepressants, Several patients might just get control by doing one of those methods without having to go further even. But even if we go further, we tell our providers to be careful and watch for the state limits for what's defined as high-dose opioids. So even if they start opioids, they have to start at a low dose, make sure they monitor the patient by urine drug screens, having opioid agreement to make sure the patient will be compliant to the treatment plan, and try to use, better than starting opioids, to try to use alternatives of interventional procedures or other things that can be actually the appropriate choice for certain patients where medications will not be very effective in general.
You mentioned physical therapy, and it seems like more and more I'm seeing people talk about this, and I'll say I've used it myself for dealing with certain kinds of pain. Is this something that we haven't really fully tapped the potential of yet?
So I think it's underutilized. I think physical therapy can be the answer to several kinds of pain, especially musculoskeletal pain. It can be very, very much responsive to physical therapy without even the need to start any pharmacological treatment.
Are you seeing the medical community embrace the ideas you're putting out there that, hey, we need to think more carefully about how and when we prescribe opioids?
That's correct. I think the awareness now is higher than ever before. Because of the good media work and showing all the statistics about that opioids are, I think, more harmful than actually helpful in our community. And by showing the presence of other alternatives that can be used for treating pain. So I think the awareness now is higher than ever before.
I want to talk about the people who have been taking opioid prescriptions, maybe for a long period of time. Maybe they are dependent on them, maybe addicted to them. Do we have enough services out there, enough resources out there to help wean them off, as you mentioned earlier?
I would say we do. We have at UW and other institutes, they all have addiction medicine programs for patients who reach the point where they know they are addicts to opioids. And then we have well-trained pain providers in multiple programs who can wean down the patient safely, again, gradually in a slow fashion while introducing other methods. So I think the help is available, and we encourage patients to seek this help and use those resources to be safely weaned off their opioids.
If there's somebody out there who says, yeah, this is me, I've been taking these a long time, or maybe someone in their family, what would be a good first step to consult with their physician to try to come up with a plan to get away from these opioid pain relievers?
I encourage those patients to contact their primary care providers and to share with them the concerns and the willing to wean down the opioids and seek other alternatives. And usually our primary care providers will discuss with us those cases or refer those cases to us so we can give recommendation. And what we do in that case, we give very clear plan about and work together how we are going to wean this patient, what we're going to do for the pain. So while weaning opioids, the pain doesn't get worse. And we develop a good plan. We have done it a lot here actually at UW since we developed our pain program, and we've been very successful in doing it.
Is this something where we need a cultural mindset change? I think when we go to the doctor, it's easy to think, if I can get a pill that treats my problem, things are going to be better, and we need to get away from going in saying, I need this quick fix in pill form, whatever the case may be?
Definitely. So we need to change this mentality, and we need to teach people more about chronic pain and the available modalities for pain management. And we get these questions from several of our patients who are in this situation that come to our clinic, who initially might think this is not possible, but after spending some more time and trying and following our recommendation, actually at the end they come back to thank us for doing this.
And is there any promising research out there that you're keeping your eye on when it comes to pain management?
Yes. So there are several studies going on finding medications to treat several conditions. I'm personally running a couple of them here at UW. One of them is for treating what's called the complex regional pain syndrome, which is a very painful condition. So we're trying to work on a new medication to treat it. Among other trials that will basically try to target certain painful conditions by new medications or available medications that were not used for that indication before. So we're running several here, and I'm aware of several other studies across the nation. So there is a promising work that hopefully in 1 or 2 years we're going to have several medications approved by the FDA for treatment of several pain conditions.
Dr. Al, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was Dr. Ala Abdel-Sayed. He's Medical Director for Pain Services at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and Public Health, and we've been talking about non-opioid treatments to manage chronic pain.
usually when we think of libraries, we think of books. But at a new event taking place this weekend at the Madison Public Library Central Branch, the books are people.
The event is called the Real Life Library Project. It's taking place this Saturday from 1 to 5 p.m. The public can check out human books and listen to them tell stories. The human books will be talking about a range of topics from growing up with HIV to recovering from a robbery.
Garrett Lee is with us now. He's one of the organizers of We Help One Another. That's the group that helped organize this event. Julie Whitaker is also with us in the studio. She's one of the so-called human books at the event, and her subject is the farewell party that she threw for her breast before getting a double mastectomy. Garrett, welcome to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Julie, so glad you could be here in studio with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Garrett, we're going to start with you. Where does this idea of a real-life library come from?
Well, there is an international group that's putting on the Human Library Project, so humanlibrary.org. I'm a very forward thinker, so I was inspired by that, no doubt, but really wanted to have it apply more to like how we teach our children and how we teach one another to be present and listen, because I believe there's a lot of power in listening, and creating opportunities for people to listen is really what we're aiming for.
And how exactly does it work? If you're one of the people listening, you show up and you want to experience this, walk us through it.
So when event attendees show up, they'll go to our registration table, and immediately after that, we have a number of different routes that they can take. But the main one that most people, I think, will be attracted to is to go to our checkout desk, where they will see a list of the books that are available for checkout. And they can choose from the menu, and then they have a half an hour session if they do check out a book, 20 minutes of listening, then a 5-minute window to reflect, and then some time to give us feedback on what they've learned, how they felt, and how we might build the event better if there is interest to have more of them.
Do the people who listen get to ask questions?
In that 5-minute window after.
That's the reflection part of it.
Correct.
And how did you find these people who are willing to act as human books and be this ambassador for understanding?
Well, this is a group project, and you know, we're a bunch of co-creators, and we all have networks in life. And so we wanted to make sure that there was some trust built in, so you tap into your own social networks. I asked about 6 of my friends who are books, and then other organizers asked some of their friends that they knew had very interesting stories in their networks.
And we'll be talking with Julie in just a moment, but what other kinds of stories are your human books going to tell? What sorts of experiences do you expect them to share?
Well, maybe I can say show up and find out.
Give us a little teaser.
You know, as you mentioned, one of the books is has grown up with HIV, and I think there's a lot of power in that story. Another friend of mine is going to talk about his faith, and that there's faith of all kinds and how faith works for him. Another one of my friends is talking about how the faith he was brought up in is different than how he practices spirituality now. There will be other people talking about recovery. There will be someone's relationship with the city and how it turned him into a person who's now an executive director at a nonprofit in town, and kind of being a success story and growing out of overcoming some of the adversity that they encountered earlier in life here. So, yeah, there's a lot of stories. We all have a story to tell, you know, and I think it's interesting when we can give people an opportunity to really connect intimately. There will be 3 readers per book, and they'll be able to sit right across a 3-foot table and have a very intimate session. There will even be an interactive section. So one of the books will invite his readers to interact with him and tell a story. So that's a new twist that we haven't really put out there. And there will be another way for people to engage if they don't have the privilege to check out one of the books, because there are a limited number of readers that can check out. We call it our open book section, and the library is going to help facilitate some activities in a project that they're sponsoring called Give and Take. And I'll just leave that as a little teaser, I think.
All right. Well, let's bring Julie in on this conversation as we talk about the upcoming Real Life Library Project, which is going to be going on this Saturday at the Madison Public Library, the Central Branch. It starts at 1 o'clock. And Julie, you're one of the human books
yes.
who will be there mm-hmm. to be checked out by people to hear your story.
Yeah.
What made you want to take part in this?
Well, as my book explanation, well, as you mentioned before, I had a double mastectomy just 2 months ago. And I knew from the time that I made the choice to have that I wanted to write about it and talk about it, partly because I am a sociologist and I think about things a lot in a sociological way, but also because it's, I think it's really healing to talk about things and not keep them private. So, I decided to make the book, my book, in quotes, about the event that I held 2 days before my surgery, which was a farewell party. And at the party, you know, I invited friends from work, neighbors, some of my students, my daughters, and we just had this, what I later became aware of as I was telling my story, it was kind of my own ritual, like a ritual that doesn't really exist in, as far as I know, of thinking about what the value is of your breasts and saying goodbye to them. Most women who have breast cancer don't really have the opportunity to do that because they have to make quick decisions. But in my case, I have a genetic mutation, BRCA2, and so I had a whole year to plan for it. I knew it was going to happen. And so, unlike most people, I was able to put some thought into a lot of things, including, I think I want to have a party. And so, yeah, and then telling the story is part of a larger project I have in mind for myself, which is to write about my experiences. This is a first attempt to talk publicly about my experiences, and I love the project. Yeah.
I can imagine that would be healing for some people who may have gone through something similar, maybe a mastectomy, yeah. but maybe another medical event that you feel like you can't talk about it because right. it's private, and sometimes people react with fear when they hear things like this, but to be so upfront and sharing it, that's got to mm-hmm. be something that will be helpful to other people too, to hear you. What do you yeah. expect to get back from these people who are listening?
Boy, that's a really good question. I actually just told my students today in my class, I teach a class called Health, Illness, and Society, ironically, and I was trying to convince my students to come to this event, and I gave them the flyer, and, you know, they read my story and they can tell what my story is about. And I was talking to one of my students after class about how people normally would react a little bit, like they might be embarrassed for me, or they might be embarrassed like they don't know what to say. So in real life, you know, if I tell my story to somebody in my classroom or on the street, I feel myself that I have to kind of lighten it up a little bit so that the person listening isn't too freaked out by it, because in our culture we don't talk about things like mastectomies, but they know what they're getting into when they come to the library. They know what my story is. So what I imagine that my audience might be people who have been personally affected by it. It could touch people. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if people, you know, are emotionally upset maybe. I know that they'll have questions, and I'm hoping it'll be a dialogue. Yeah, I don't know, really.
And Garrett, I want to ask you about this. Julie's story has the potential to have some powerful emotions evoked there. Why is it better in this case? Maybe not better, but what about this option of hearing a one-on-one, hearing from a real person about their experience is powerful to you instead of checking out a book? Because there are memoirs about dealing with cancer and mastectomies. What's special about this?
I think it's all about the personal connection. There's a different way of digesting and taking in information when it's humanized. And I think that, you know, in today's day and age, we don't have a lot of opportunities to slow down and to hear people and how real life affects their life and how they have to make difficult choices or respond to difficult circumstances. And I firmly believe that this will be an opportunity, not just for listening, but listening is the root of where empathy comes from. And I think there's a lot of people who are becoming increasingly challenged. Let's just say that in the way culture is right now. in the environment and what we see happening, across the nation. So I think that one of the best ways that we can be proactive against that is to create space to humanize one another, to really hear people for who they are, to really give them a voice and give them the gift of our attention.
And just briefly, for both of you, we've got less than a minute. What do you hope comes out of this event on Saturday? Julie, let's start with you.
Yeah. I was really excited to see, as I looked at the flyer, the diversity of people who are going to be books of the 15, just a real range of race and ethnicities and ages and stories. And so I hope it's the beginning of a project where people come together across difference.
Great. And Garrett?
I think Julie took the words right out of my mouth. That was an excellent synopsis of what I hope. I also want to remind people that we are video recording these, right? So even if people don't have the opportunity to attend the event, we're building an app where people will be able to check out these books at a later date and then write a book report to say what they learned and how they felt from that experience. And then they can get credit for it, too. That's a little teaser, a credit for the good vibes that you share.
Well, thank you both so much for coming in and sharing your stories with us today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.
That was Garrett Lee, founder of We Help One Another, which is organizing the Real Life Library Project. Also with us, Julie Whitaker, who is one of the human books. She teaches sociology at Edgewood College. And this event takes place at Madison Public Library Central Branch at 1 o'clock.
Coming up, the Dodd-Frank federal banking regulations and why they may be on the chopping block. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up tonight after 7, it's True Stories Told Live on the Moth Radio Hour. Tonight, 4 stories about our relationship to home, yearning for a place to call home, leaving one home in search of another, and coming to find beauty and a true sense of belonging. That's tonight after 7 here on the Ideas Network.
First, Congress passed the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act in 2010, following the economic fallout of the Great Recession. The act sought to regulate banks and protect consumers in order to head off a future economic crisis.
Lawmakers have never quite seen eye to eye over that legislation, but Republicans in particular would like to see the Dodd-Frank Act overturned. And with President Trump in the White House, the legislation could get overturned sooner than later.
Jared Bennett joins us now. He's a digital editor and reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. That's a nonpartisan, nonprofit investigative news organization. Jared, welcome to Central Time.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's start with the basics. What key things does the Dodd-Frank Act do?
It's a really complicated bill. As you know, you may remember we had a lot of problems to solve in the wake of the Great Recession. So there's a lot of stuff crammed into Dodd-Frank. But the best way to describe it is that it tried to be a little bit more forward-looking and say, the general consensus is that we had the tools to regulate banks before the crash, and we just weren't using them, or regulation wasn't sort of under the same roof. And so what Dodd-Frank tried to do was create systems so that, regulators could keep a sort of forward-looking eye on banks and the activities that they're up to. So a lot of what's in it is things like, they created a council to sort of to put a lot of financial regulation under one roof, and that is the Financial Stability Oversight Council. A lot of what it was trying to do was about reporting and making sure we have the information about what banks are up to.
One of the steps in this legislation was the so-called stress test, where federal regulators, as I understand, would kind of do a little shakedown cruise for a bank and see if they were at risk of falling apart. Has that been one of the controversial points?
It has been controversial for, when they first started doing the stress tests, there was a few rounds where some of the bigger banks, there's some question about whether they would pass or not. But now a lot of the controversy is really about from the banks and the industries that are regulated that these stress tests are sort of the reasoning is, you know, a little bit opaque and not exactly clear. And so one of the proposals for rolling back Dodd-Frank would actually give banks a little bit more say in, you know, look, we know what we're doing. We're involved in this industry every day, and so we should be able to have a say in, you know, what determines whether we pass a stress test or not. So that is one of the more controversial items and one of the things sort of on the table to be tweaked.
Sounds like another aspect on the table maybe to be tweaked is changing the too-big-to-fail legislation for what actually happens when a bank goes bankrupt. How might that change?
Yeah, so that is a very controversial aspect of it. You know, depending on who you talk to, one of the big criticisms of Dodd-Frank is that it didn't end too big to fail. Now, sort of on the Democratic side, what they'll say is that, you know, that's a fair criticism. They didn't break up the big banks. They decided not to do that. But what they did do is put these sort of forward-looking processes in place so that, you know, like I said, they're going to be paying attention to banks ahead of time and sort of keep making sure that they can see things as they come on the horizon. But should one get in trouble, and there's a few layers of protections that and steps that they would go through, and the final one being an orderly liquidation process, which is where, you know, the bank would sort of be taken over by federal government and wound down in a way that would cause, you know, that wouldn't require bailout in the way that we a lot of banks did require a bailout after the crisis. And it would sort of be a bit more organized and structured process. This banks are also required to hold living wills now, which is kind of exactly what it sounds like. It's something that says, should we get into trouble? Should we hit a speed bump that we don't know about? This is our plan for winding down in a way that won't cause a systematic collapse of the economy.
Talking to Jared Bennett from the Center for Public Integrity, looking at a Dodd-Frank Wall Street and banking legislation from 2010 on the chopping block, or a lot of it. And Jared, let's get into the politics this week. President Trump talking about this said, I think it was, we're going to do a number on Dodd-Frank. What's leading the opposition to this among congressional Republicans and now the new president?
So Dodd-Frank, when it was passed, it was pretty controversial. It was really passed in a state of or directly following a state of crisis. So a lot of pushback, especially from some of the industries that it regulates, that it goes too far and that, you know, it's sort of creates the term nanny state is thrown around a lot. You know, it's a lot of sort of overreach and sort of telling people how to run their business. You hear that a lot. The big sort of talking point that you hear a lot is that it's very hard on smaller banks and community banks, credit unions. And now, interestingly, you know, like I said, Dodd-Frank didn't end sort of the big banks. It didn't break up those, and actually their market share has increased during this period after Dodd-Frank. You know, that's where there's a lot of discussion and a lot of argument about is this sort of caused by Dodd-Frank, or is it trends that were in place long before Dodd-Frank even came along, and it's just part of technology and the industry in general.
What do you see in the tea leaves for the Consumer Financial Protections Bureau?
Yeah, that is probably the most kind of high-profile aspect of Dodd-Frank and consumer financial regulation that you'll probably see a pretty big fight over. And now a lot of the changes that have been proposed to it can actually be done without legislation. So the two sort of big picture changes would be things like changing it from a single director, which it has now, to a commission, a five-person commission. And then the other one would be taking its funding away from directly from the Federal Reserve, which is now, and placing it under the congressional appropriations process. And that would depending on what side of the argument you're on, that would either make it a little bit more accountable to elected officials, because that would lead to debate in Congress about, should we fund this agency, that's up to all sorts of things. Should we fund it at this level, or should we roll it back, or having a little bit more hand in sort of looking at what it's actually up to. And then on the other side, that the argument is that would politicize the agency, which is really supposed to be apolitical and really looking out for consumers, and could subject it to a lot of gridlock and a lot of standstill in an environment that some of this stuff, regulators and the CFPB, they want to be able to react fast to things like the Wells Fargo crisis. Crisis is not the right word. Wells Fargo issue, where we had a few months ago, where they're opening accounts without customers' knowledge. The CFPB was able to get on top of that fairly quickly, and with these changes, that it's not clear whether they'd be able to react right away or whether they'd have to go to Congress to say there's an issue, we want to react to it. So there's a lot of questions about that, but that is definitely one of the higher profile fights I think we'll see.
And Jared, in a piece you wrote about this, you followed some of the campaign donation money from big banks to people supporting changes in this banking regulation change. What kind of things did you find out?
Yeah, so this is, we in 2014, we had written a story about what we called the Banking Caucus. And these were people, representatives in the House that get a lot of money from financial institutions. It's a lot of, most of them are on the House Financial Services Committee, which that is the committee that decides laws on financial regulation. So it makes sense that that's where the money would be going. We found a lot of, the money is pretty staggering. It's a lot of money, as you saw. The leader that we were able to sort of look at his campaign contributions was Jeb Hensarling. There also Sean Duffy from Wisconsin was on our list, and also a co-sponsor of the sort of high-profile legislation that would target Dodd-Frank coming up. It's a lot of money from banks. We're talking, I'm looking at right now $4 million to over $4 million to Hensarling Jeb Hensarling over his career. But it's not just banks. Also, that's sort of a key point. A lot of this money comes from commercial banks. That would be the Bank of America's, the Wells Fargo's, but a lot of it also is from, hedge funds, private equity firms, insurance agencies are a big one. AIG received the largest bailout after the financial crash, and that was an insurance agency, not a bank. So,
Jared Bennett is with us from the Center for Public Integrity, looking at efforts to overturn parts of the Dodd-Frank Act, which regulates banks.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Should the Dodd-Frank Act stay in place, or should Congress repeal it all or in part? Do you think banks should be heavily regulated? Should the federal government keep a close eye on them, especially after the crash back in 2008 and the Great Recession? Or should banks be able to go about their business and self-regulate as much as possible? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. 1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're continuing our conversation about the state of the Dodd-Frank banking regulations under the Trump administration. Jared Bennett is with us, digital editor and reporter for the Center for Public Integrity.
And we'd like to hear from you on this. What do you think about the Dodd-Frank Act potentially being dismantled? How closely should banks be regulated? And do you want more oversight of American financial institutions, or do the regulations maybe hurt the economy? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or you can leave a comment on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll go to our callers now. Terry is on the line with us in Green Bay. Terry, hi.
Good afternoon. I'm very much in favor of keeping Dodd-Frank on the books. The government is supposed to be there to protect people, and we should have regulations that, of course, are going to protect people and their money. To just get rid of this is basically allowing the banks to step on people and to get every buck they can. And we've already seen what they can do after 2008 and the economy crashing. If we don't have regulation, we're just going to see this again in some new form.
Terry, thanks for the call. And Jared, is that the sort of thing we're hearing from advocates for banking regulation and from maybe Democrats in Congress?
Absolutely, especially with regards to things like the CFPB. There are two sorts of regulation involved with Dodd-Frank, sort of mouthful of a name. There's the big picture financial regulation stuff that is about our financial system as a whole, making sure that if part of it goes down, it's not going to bring the rest of it down. And then the other part of it is consumer protection and establishing how much can agencies like the CFPB, but some other agencies also, the OCC is a great is another regulator that's involved in some of these consumer protection issues. How much can they get out and ahead of issues and respond to things that are maybe abusive to consumers? And like you said, this is that sort of, like your caller said, that really goes down to individuals, working people, whether they open, anyone with a bank account, really, or a mortgage or things like that.
I want to go back to our callers now. We have Ann joining us next in Madison. Ann, hi.
Hi. I am very much in support of keeping and even strengthening Dodd-Frank. My opinion is that the bailouts to these banks and insurance and other large institutions that are considered too big to fail, that's a form of theft, in my opinion, from the taxpayer.
Ann, thanks a lot for that. And are there people, Jared, in Congress who agree with Ann, who will be defending Dodd-Frank, maybe making it stronger is not really on the table, but who agrees with that point of view?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Probably the most visible defender of Dodd-Frank is Elizabeth Warren from Massachusetts, the senator from Massachusetts. She was instrumental in creating the CFPB, she is out and already sort of out ahead and saying, we made this law for a reason. We are responding to a crisis in our country, and so we made it for a reason, and we should keep these protections in place. And also on the other side, though, that's one of the main arguments for opening it up and getting rid of some of these protections is that it didn't. The argument would go that the conditions that caused the bailout, these big bailouts are still there, and that's an argument that is still playing out, and we're, no one's really won that discussion yet.
Thanks for that call, Ann, at 800-642-1234. Talking to Jared Bennett from the Center for Public Integrity, looking at Dodd-Frank banking legislation from 7 years ago and likely efforts to change, repeal, replace parts of it. Jared, a lot of this, as you mentioned, doesn't need even Congress to weigh in on, or some of it. Some Congress would have to. This isn't all a slam dunk, it sounds like. You say there might be some Senate Republicans in particular who are a little shy about changing some of these.
Hello?
Is that right? Jared? Jared, are you still there? I think our guest isn't hearing us. I kind of Oh, Jared, are you there? Nope. Looks like we've lost Jared Bennett with the Center for Public Integrity. We'll put him on hold and see if he can hear us. But in the meantime, we'll take another caller with thoughts on Dodd-Frank. Dwayne is with us in Weston. Dwayne, hi.
Yes, hi. I think it should be kept and strengthened. And I just think anywhere there's money, there's going to be corruption and greed. And if you could get rid of that, I'd say get rid of the regulations. But until then, I think you should have regulators on the regulators because, I mean, they have, it's just, we had a company CEO that fudged books and our stock went overnight and it happened overnight, because of greed and corruption, you know. And
got it, Dwayne. Thanks for sharing your thoughts. And I think we have Jared back. And Jared, Dwayne, another caller wanting Dodd-Frank to stay in place. And I was asking you when we lost the connection there, are Senate Republicans going to be on board with all these changes we're talking about?
I think what I've been hearing is that, you know, for the most part, Senate Republicans are sort of a unified front on a lot of the changes, the sort of big picture changes, the core changes that they want to make. The key, from what I've been hearing in my discussions with people working on the Hill, are that is whether moderate Democrats will be, you know, willing to step up for this and fight for a lot of things that were that people like Elizabeth Warren and Sherrod Brown of Ohio. You know, these are two; those are two examples of very visible Democrats that are going to fight for Dodd-Frank. The key will be, from what I've been told, is, you know, whether moderate Democrats are going to step up.
How likely, Jared, do you think it is that parts of Dodd-Frank will go to reconciliation instead of straightforward through Congress?
That is very likely, especially on certain things like the funding of CFPB and the sort of structure of some of the regulatory agencies. You know, this the legislation that we focused on my story this week was the Choice Act from Jeb Hensarling. He's the chairman of the House Financial Services Committee. And, you know, that was introduced last session. It's going to be reintroduced in this session, but with a lot of changes. But that's generally considered the starting point. And a lot of those things, like you said, can be done through reconciliation. But those are a lot of the sort of structural things and tweaks, whereas changes to the system of, you know, things like designating what banks are automatically set aside for increased scrutiny, those things will probably require a little bit more legislative push.
And we leave it there. Jared, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Jared Bennett is a digital editor and reporter for the Center for Public Integrity. He joined us to talk about the fate of the Dodd-Frank Act under the Trump administration.
Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll hear about threats facing our primate cousins around the globe.
On Food Friday, we'll spice up the Wisconsin winter with some Cajun and Creole-style cooking.
And UFOs are coming to Wisconsin in film. We'll meet the producer of a new documentary about a UFO festival in Dundee, Wisconsin.
That's all coming up tomorrow right here on Central Time.